This week on the Eldritch Lorecast.
This question has made me realize something shocking about myself.
Ben Byrne, he's just like you.
Only covered in tartar sauce.
Are you really that opposed to Point Buy because it maxes out at 15?
Yes.
That's one of the things I love about Point Buy.
I thought you might.
D&D Beyond comes to Kickstarter.
There was so much clamoring about, oh, D&D's a walled garden.
A sort of squirrel pool.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Thank it's you. Like a less threatening Sharknado.
D&D sales down 30% in 2023.
This dream sequence could have been an email.
Are we doing a new edition of the Eldritch Lorecast? Yeah. Is it backwards compatible?
Much more streamlined.
Yeah. New player friendly.
Advanced yeah. Eldritch Lorecast.
All that and more right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one swing music podcast in all the realms. That's right. You have just tuned in time to listen to all the latest news and information from your favorite swing bands. My name's Ben Byrne. I'm here with Cale Dinsmill, Hames Jake, and Morn Sherwin. Morn, I do have a question for you. What's your favorite jazz band?
Duke Ellington is hard to top, I think.
What about you, Cale?
I've got a bunch of mixed CDs that my uncle made me, and he's a big jazz fiend. I don't know who any of these people are. That's my answer.
Okay, fair enough. And Hames, what about your fine self?
Well, if you had to ask me for the classics, I'd say Count Basie. But if you're asking for someone newer, the late Roy Hargrove is fantastic. Strasbourg St. Denis is my favorite jazz song of all time. And for jazz fusion, it's Nujabes.
I feel deeply offended that you both knew jazz.
Yeah, but anyway, my name's Ben Byrne here with Sean Moe and Dale Kingsmill. James Haig, this is the number one tabletop RPG podcast and dice picking podcast.
You would never know it.
In all the realms, no. We'll see if you've made it through this far, you've made it to the real podcast. Congratulations. And as for today's actual starting question, because I am curious to know this, Sean Merwin, when you are playing D&D or any tabletop RPG and you need to reference a rule, do you prefer to, or is your automatic go-to, digital resources or physical resources?
The answer is both, depending on the situation. Digital, if I can. But if I'm running a game and I have an adventure here and monster stats here and something else here and no place to plug my appliances in, then I have to go analog with sheets of paper printed in 12 different directions, note cards, and it gets as analog as you possibly can to a point where someone may need to call an ambulance because I paper cut myself into oblivion.
Fair enough. James Haig, what about yourself? Do you struggle with paper cuts as well?
Death by 1,000 paper cuts, is that a thing? No. I think that the resources I use the most these days are digital maps. Chepeku's maps in particular.
Okay.
I usually, their repository of maps is so large and I get it just by subbing their Patreon every month with all of these variants and stuff. Basically, no matter what I've homebrewed that week, I can find something close enough and in a pretty, beautiful, well-rendered large size on top of it all.
This question has made me realize something shocking about myself. Which is that I don't think I bring the player's handbook with me to D&D games. I'm just now realizing this because I was thinking, I was like, it's just whatever is closest, right? Like if I don't have the book nearby, then I'm looking it up on my phone. But if I'm, wandering around my room preparing stuff, I've got books splayed out everywhere. I'll reach for the nearest book. Man. I really just don't bring that. I don't bring the rules with me to the table, which is an interesting choice. But I also, I don't know how often I reference rules mid-game anyway. Occasionally, no. I might need to look up something about how a class ability works, but usually I think I just wing it.
I think it's my wargamer instincts that forbid me from kind of just making up rules too willy-nilly, like if I don't know even where to look for the rule, then I probably won't. But like, for example, the other day somebody cast Guiding Bolt and it was like, is Guiding Bolt 3d6? Is it 2d8? What is it 2d10? What is Guiding Bolt? And I had to know the actual dice. It wasn't enough for me to just be like, ah, roll 3d10. That'll do for the moment.
Probably. Yeah, that's probably about right. But if it's something like, oh, look up fall damage. I never remember what fall damage is. Right, but I also know that the fall damage rules are unsatisfying to me. So I'm happy to just like go, I'm going to roll this many dice.
Well, people used to joke to me whenever I'd rock up to play D&D at their house, especially when I was a GM for hire, that they're like, oh, you must be moving in, because I'd rock up with a backpack and a kind of roller bag, mainly for me because I carry a lot of miniatures, because of that, you know, I enjoy that part of the game, but also because I used to have my player's handbook, my monster manual, and my DMG. And then that became my player's handbook, my monster manual, my DMG, and Xanathar's Guide to Everything. And then it was my player's handbook, my monster manual, my DMG, my Xanathar's Guide to Everything, my Tasha's Cauldron of every, you know, like that stack was getting bigger. My Grim Hollow player's guide and campaign guide and Monster Grimoire kind of added to that stack as well. And I've realized more recently, without even meaning to, I have stopped taking particularly like Tasha's and Xanathar's, because it is, I don't even know if it's quicker to flick through a book or search on D&D Beyond, because your internet speed can dictate that sometimes.
And also the search function on D&D Beyond is really bad.
Yeah, I will agree. But yeah, it's just, it is interesting to me to see that stack of books shrink and how, you know, habits change without even necessarily realizing.
Whoa, 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 Atomic Sorcery in chat. How did we get to the point where point buy doesn't matter? Whoa, whoa, whoa. They say Dale's Table where the rules are made up and the point buy doesn't matter. Point buy matters. Although I will never have my players use point buy because I don't like that it maxes
Dale,
out.
Dale, have you ever watched the improv comedy show Whose Line Is It Anyway? By
Drew
Carey. Okay. I just wanted to make sure you were getting that joke because I didn't know if it was an American thing.
Because the points don't matter.
Because the points don't matter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you really that opposed to point buy because it maxes out at 15?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's one of the things I love about point buy. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. Yeah. Is somebody enjoying themselves at my table? Absolutely not. I won't stand for it. No, it's because, look, I'm going to go into this. It's because, and we've probably talked about this before, at level one, I think it's completely acceptable for a character to start with a max stat, a max possible stat of 15 or 16 if they're using their ability score increases, or 17, I suppose, if you use the plus two, because they're a level one character. And therefore, it makes the choice, particularly at level four, between choosing a feat or choosing an ability score increase more meaningful, because it's like, oh, that ability score increase will actually help me quite a lot now, because I, you know, I've only been able to get to 17 at best, or 16 probably, but this feat would allow me to flavor my character in a specific way, as opposed to like having, you know, an 18, a 16, and a 14 at level one, and just being like, I don't need the ability score increase.
I completely agree with you. Mathematically, logically, you're right. It's the best option. But I want to roll my dice.
Yes.
I want to roll them. I want that kind of, that like discovery element. Ooh, what am I going to get? Bam, there it is. I like that there is the chance that I'll get, you know, a 7 in the mix. Oh no, a 7. What am I going to do with this? I don't know. You are 100% right. I think we've yet to find what is the best method for character stat generation within the D&D format.
Well, because there are so many different what people want, right?
5d4.
Right. 6D2.7. Now, if you play with the right group, you will find the best way. But if you play with a group where you have players who want to cheat, okay, I'll just say it. They want to cheat. They want high stats. They want to roll. And because they know that if they roll poorly, you're going to say, oh, I'm sorry, that character is unplayable, until they finally roll to a point where they have high stats. And if you play with enough players like that, it quickly gets to the point where you say, okay, yes, let's use point buy. We're all on even footing. And you can tailor your character exactly the way you want. Sure, you're not going to get the less than 8 in more than 17, but you're going to get there.
See, it's so real because I'm one of those freaks who I'm like, ooh, I want there to be something that's really high and something that's really low. I like that. And there are a lot of people who are like that, but there are a lot of people who are like what you're saying. Yeah. And I mean, when I made up my silly little Wild West game, I had some ludicrous method of stat generation. And I remember deliberately building a thing where I was like, okay, how do I entice them to make it more even? And I basically ended up saying, okay, you get a special bonus to like your starting like cash and stuff because you're a high roller. If you donate some of your stats to someone who rolled worse, you get like this other special boost. Nice. I don't know. I think there are ways to do it, but it's also not like the most valuable way to spend time in the world.
Here's an interesting thing with the AD&D Unearthed Arcana, the book that came out with more player options. One of the alternatives to regular, there were five or six different ways you could roll stats. But what they did was like, okay, you're a barbarian, roll 9d6, take the highest three. However, only roll 3d6 for wisdom or intelligence, and that's all you get. You don't get even 4d6, and you just take what you take. And it was interesting because it did that thing where It sort of worked, but it was so different from what had come before that there was outrage for the most part. And one way to do it is just, all right, you're a cleric. You start with 14 and add a d4. For your whatever dexterity, you're going to start with an 8 and roll a d4. That's another way to do it that will help you tailor the character to fit its niche. And you can still end up with some good numbers, but you avoid some of the problems of people. Oh, I rolled all 18s. Yeah, I did. I mean, I rolled for 72 hours straight using my computer, and I rolled an infinite number of times, and that's it. Finally, came up. Technically, I did it.
I swear I will let this conversation point die at some stage, but never. I did just remember that I not that long ago devised a way of generating characters that's basically like a White Elephant Christmas where, you know, there's the... So the idea was that everyone rolls for one stat, but then you can, when you roll, you can trade with the person who rolled before you. Like, you can do that whole thing, and it just... Right. Sort of rolls around. I don't know if it's good, but I have like five different pages of spreadsheets where I was trying it out. So that's what my brain does. There's a glimpse into my life.
There's probably also some good variables that would maybe take up too much words in a new player's guide, but maybe in a new DMG or something that's like, here's the standard point buy kind of, 27 points to purchase your stats. Here's an alternative version where you get like 32 points and we're going to add a 16 and a 7 to either ends of the scale if you want a more extreme version or you want more powerful characters kind of generally. Here's a standard array. Here's a bit of a squirrelier standard array that's a little bit higher and a little bit lower on both ends. Yeah, squirrelier. I'm sticking with it. That's a word.
Oh, that's super.
Okay. So there's probably some good alternatives.
Keep in mind that Australians say squirrel.
Squirrels don't exist here, Dale, so I'm not sure that that's true. I don't think I believe that.
You just said squirrel.
I said squirrely.
Is Australia the least squirreliest country?
Oh, no, mate. We're the squirreliest.
Are you telling me that when Americans say that someone is squirrely, that they're saying a totally different word than the animal squirrel?
No, that's correct, Dale. We are actually.
Yeah, but then why is he saying squirrely?
Because I feel like the way you just said squirrel was like squirrel. With an American accent.
No, it that wasn't. Made it sound more syllables.
Squirrel. Squirrel.
Well, I was doing an American accent when I said squirrely.
Yeah, okay.
We would say squirrely because it's a squirrel.
Yeah, but I say squirrely.
Yeah, okay, but you shouldn't.
Right. Rhymes with curly.
Yeah, exactly.
There and you how go. Would, okay. No.
Squirrel. Right. I've just realized I've probably been using an expression with no realization that it has connection to an animal whatsoever because squirrel, to me, sounds like squirrel as in like, I don't know.
Like swirly, but with a like Q.
Exactly
a
that.
Sort of squirrel
yeah.
tool.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like
thank
a
you.
Less threatening Sharknado.
Oh,
That's going in the pre-roll. All right, let us move on to some news, some tabletop news. Speaking of digital versus physical, D&D Beyond comes to Kickstarter for the first time. That's right. We weren't able to announce it last week before the Kickstarter went live, but Monsters of Drakenheim is the first 5e Kickstarter to have a D&D Beyond available as a digital deluxe backer tier. So my understanding is you back, you choose that tier. It's likely also an add-on, and you can choose your digital tabletop being Roll20, Foundry, or D&D Beyond to get all the monsters on there. How did you folks, when you heard that, find the news?
I made a YouTube face directly at the screen. I was like,
oh, thank you so much, Dale. Thank you so much.
Wait, I gotta make sure my hair looks good when I do it. All right,
we'll give you another.
All right.
Okay, great. And I appreciate that you held it for a moment too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Kill the blur.
Dante, use whichever one looks best. Oh, wait, Ben, you make the
yeah.
Use
yeah.
whichever one looks best.
Just all of them. Somebody called me out for using the James Hake, the initial shocked expression when you were driving in New Zealand too much. So I was going to try and make a thumbnail.
No.
I was going to try and make a thumbnail that was just four of you doing that. And that was all it was.
If that's what I become known for, if that's what I go down in history for, annoying thumbnail for Eldritch Lorecast, I'll take it.
We should all do them so that they have a range of options.
Sure. Well, I can tell you right now that a lot of people I know in the industry, when they heard that, definitely made that face.
They made what face? This face.
That face, yeah. That face right there.
Great.
There was so much clamoring about, oh, D&D's a walled garden. It's never going to let anyone else in. And then slowly that wall has been eroding. And we are seeing this infrastructure that Wizards of the Coast has built through D&D Beyond open up more and more to this point. You can't even imagine that it's going to slow down. Unless there is a very compelling reason to, because we've already seen partnerships announced with Cobalt Press, with the Humblewood Hit Point Press, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I know more are coming, and we are seeing a brave new world here of digital D&D access and integration.
You know, I wonder if this means that Wizards is listening. You know what I mean? Yeah, there was this huge and well-deserved blow up of Wizards around, you know, this time last year, right? A little earlier than this time last year. And a big part of that was directed, not necessarily at the specifics of what happened, but that there was a general sentiment of Wizards wants to bury third-party creators. And I wonder how long this has been in the works for, right? Is this a reaction to that? Based on the gradual pace of it, it seems like maybe so. Maybe Wizards wants to make a stronger connection with their third-party base because they can tell that the people who are really passionate about D&D really love one or more third-party publishers, be it Ghostfire or Kobold or whosoever.
007190 Pats, great name, in chat says, is it too little too late though? And it is an interesting question. I don't think that it will prove to be, but I understand that it is. It's really strange feeling of having to react to this kind of stuff in the wake of a lot of bad news that's come attached to Hasbro and the Seattle company. You know, it's weird coming from. They've just fired a lot of people. Although I still don't think that sounds like it was a Wizard's choice so much as a Hasbro choice, but it's, you know, there's a lot of sad stuff and a lot of stuff that has made people really angry over the last year plus. And it's weird having things that are genuinely good happen alongside that. Mm-hmm. And I can understand people struggling to balance those feelings. But I think the further you distance yourself from the company as like a person, the more that you can just kind of react to individual things that are happening, because it's all in the name of business in the end. And that makes me sound extra cynical, but I mean that as in a perfectly neutral way. You get good things because of that and you get bad things because of that. But will it be too little too late? I don't know. We'll have to see how all these other games that have been created post OGL crisis do.
Yeah, I mean, I always encourage people to make their own decisions and try not to get swept up in online furor. Try to kind of cut through the noise a little bit to kind of understand where other people are coming from in a way, you know, because, for example, I think this is fantastic. This is really cool. And I think that Cobalt Press being on there is really cool for what I said, was it last week or the week before, in terms of I've used Tome of Beasts less over time because I've started using D&D Beyond more. But a lot of Tome of Beasts monsters are probably going to go back into my rotation of monsters that I choose because I'm finding them organically through searching for monsters in D&D Beyond. And that's going to be true for Monsters of Drakenheim. That's going to be true the more third-party kind of player options that they may choose to put onto D&D Beyond in future. I don't know anything for the record. But of course, also understanding that, like, this podcast is funded by Ghostfire. So it's worth people just trying, not getting swept away in the good news or the bad news or whatever, but just understanding where different people are coming from, why they might be having the reaction that they're having, and then making up your own mind about it. And understanding when people are trying to convince you of something as opposed to presenting something as fact, which is why I got so upset last week at the Larian Studios no longer doing Baldur's Gate 3 news. And boy, howdy, did I hook a few people with that thumbnail, judging by the comments. But, you know, it's people present fact as... people present their opinions as fact very frequently and their interpretations of news as fact very frequently. So in terms of deciding whether you're upset about something or not or elated is just figuring out what your own position is. Nevertheless, Monsters of Drakenheim, doing great. Thank you so much for people who have funded it so far. I believe this is true. I don't know off the top of my head, but I believe this is the fastest growing Ghostfire Kickstarter that we've done so far. I think it's definitely true for a Drakenheim. I think we made almost 500K just in the first 24 hours. So thank you very much for folks who have funded it so far. I'm just going to drop a quick link in the chat if folks want to go and check it out. That's news. Go listen to the cinematic trailer. Dante did a fantastic job on that working with the dudes. So it's really cool. Speaking of not swing or jazz music. We probably don't need to report on this every time it happens because it's happening with increasing frequency, but another free adventure has dropped on D&D Beyond. If you're a member of D&D Beyond, you can go get it. Descent into the Lost Caverns of Sodge Kanth, which is an abridged quick play version of the Lost Caverns of Sodge Kanth, which is coming within Quest from the Infinite Staircase. 3 to 4 hour adventure for 9th level characters. That's nice and healthy
solid
levels.
Solid, yeah.
Includes 6 pre-generated character sheets that you can use if you just want to jump in. And kind of the newsy bit of this being that there is optional tournament rules that set a strict 4-hour time limit on the adventure, allow a single short rest, and use a score sheet to track the party's performance and stores and conventions that run the adventure as an organized play event.
Bring back competitive D&D.
Indeed. We're back there.
I'm for it. That sounds exciting. That makes me want to play.
We should compete against each other.
Do it.
No, I don't think we can compete against each other.
I think we need to have a team play. It ran at GaryCon, and I think people enjoyed it. The Dungeon Masters who ran it, who are pretty experienced convention DMs, said that one of them specifically said that it was the best sort of competitive event that he's ever run.
Oh, wow.
And he has experience running a lot of them. People seem to enjoy it. I know Dan Dillon did some work on it along with Justice at Wizards. And they've updated the old adventure. It's not just here's the old adventure and we've just made a couple of tweaks. It is a full-on change adaptation using 5e rules and new 2024 sensibilities of play, but also has that old school feel with depending on what you do in each individual room, you might get a bonus or a penalty to your score. So it's an interesting new way, old way to play D&D.
How do they score competitive?
If D&D? I had to, I could tell you, Dale, but then if we played
you'd have to kill me?
If we played it, then yes. Well, I wouldn't have
then
to.
Then I would know how it,
Exactly. Let's think of it this way. So you go into a room and there's an altar and there is a puzzle on the altar. You might get a point if you solve the puzzle within 3 minutes, or 2 points. If you solve the puzzle within 5 minutes, you might get 1 point. If you fail to solve the puzzle, you might get -1 point. Or if you say the magic word that you gleaned through several clues, you might get 2 points for bypassing it altogether. That's the sort of scoring that happens.
Gotcha. They should put lots of riddles in them because those are even, and I am not good at riddles.
I'd imagine this encourages a certain style of play, because when I was just looking at the map of the adventure, I was kind of like, really? 4 hours? You could get through this in 4 hours? I know groups that take, you know, 45 minutes just to get out the front door away from the quest giver. So I assume that this basically dumps you in the dungeon straight away. There's no like quest giver scene necessarily. Mm. But I'd imagine like if the DM's like, you know, you look and in front of you is this altar with a purple tapestry drape. Yeah, yeah, whatever. What's the puzzle? What's the puzzle? I don't care about the, don't give me the flowery description. What's the puzzle?
I had a really interesting experience of this sort of thing when I, at Origins 2017, was invited to run the special tables for Tomb of Annihilation's D&D epic. I think I've talked about it on this show before, but it was a race to the center of a lost temple. And then when people got to the center, really, it's like 50 tables of people, right? This undead dinosaur burst out and then you had to escape from the center. The first like six parties or so that made it to the middle were taken aside and brought up to the ballroom's balcony to play at one of six special event tables, which one slowed them down for part two of the adventure because they had to go do their own thing. But it gave them something special to do, a whole separate set of encounters that no one else, and rewards, right, also, that no one else at the epic got to do. And I had never DM'd, I think I got something like a tier three or tier four party, and I had never DM'd Adventurers League, let alone for a group that high level. And let me tell you, I was trying to do the showmanship, but like I could feel their heat rays coming out of their eyes on me with every word I spoke. Right.
I feel like I would too.
Yeah. 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 And they were just like, you know, we summon a Deva. Does it die? Okay. Never mind. This is a different kind of game than I expected to play. But it was really cool. But yes, definitely a very different sort of extremely efficient style of D&D play.
It's not that you can't role play, it's that you're role playing people who are efficient and don't want to waste any time.
Yes, we are role playing people who are under a time pressure to get out of this maze, and I can't argue with that.
I suppose it'll probably be at Gen Con, right? And I don't know if they've said that, but looks cool.
I love that we have such a habit on this podcast of being like, when's it releasing? I don't know, probably like Gen Con.
Well, the you can go get it right now. The actual free adventure version of this, you can go get it right now. I went and had a look at it. And that, like I said, I looked at the map and I was like, really? This looks pretty full on. Like just fighting the monster at the end of the adventure could take my group an hour. You know what I mean? Like...
Not if there were points on the line.
That's right.
Maybe I'm underestimating ninth level adventurers as well. Maybe the whole intention is that combat goes for a round or two.
This is the solution to the common complaint that combat takes too long. They're just going to start training the community to play faster.
Is there, actually, I do have a question, Sean, because you said at the top we should give this a go. Now, it would not be useful for each of us to just go in as a solo adventurer and compete against each other. But is there like standard number of points for a sort of solo competitive version where it's like, all right, if you scored this many points, you've done really well on average, you know, based on average of what most people score. If you score under this, you've done really poorly and you've taken too long and blah, 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 blah.
I don't think there is one in this adventure. I think the gist of it is you expect to have six players using the six pre-generated characters. So as long as everyone is on the same footing, you're only comparing yourself to the other group who was running it in the exact same situation. And it'll be hard to do now because people could just read it. And when it ran at GaryCon, it had not been released yet. And the DMs that were running it were like under strict orders not to discuss it anywhere, not to run a practice round of it for any people who might be at the convention, only talk to each other about it. So it was, you know, they took it fairly seriously because there were some pretty cool prizes given to the groups that won. Now, game stores could run it, but any of your players could go on to D&D Beyond, grab it, and know exactly. Well, I go up and I say this to the statue. Well, congratulations, you win.
Makes sense when you look back in the early days of D&D, then, why there were so many fairly short competitive adventures, right? You know, they would debut at Gen Con. No way to get spoiled when you're running Tomb of Horrors for the very first time.
Also, phones didn't have the internet.
That's true. You can't just look it up there and then in your D&D Beyond account, you know, under the table or something. I was trying to see if you needed a specific subscription to D&D Beyond to be able to access it. I'm not sure. I think the lowest tier of subscription will probably get you access to it, but don't quote me on that. Let me tell you about Into the AM, the sponsor for this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. James, how important is it for you to express yourself with your clothing?
Incredibly important to me, I say, wearing a white t-shirt.
That's fair enough. Sean, you're always wearing great like D&D merch and things like that. Dale, what about yourself?
I love fashion. Look, this jumper, simple, but I look great in it.
That's fair. See, I tend to be less about strict fashion, more about mood. You know, what I'm wearing often affects my mood. If I'm playing D&D, if I'm mastering D&D, I like to have a graphic tee on, a nerd shirt, something Norse inspired. If it's if I'm running, like Valakan clans, or something more kind of Japanese inspired. If I'm playing my Japanese successionist army in Infinity. And let me tell you, Into the AM have some fantastic collections of graphic tees like this astronaut falling through space. I don't know if you can see it, but it's genuinely a cool shirt. I really like the colors on it.
It's very impressive that he's falling in space.
It is. look at the lines he's leaving behind. He's just kind of drifting and
that right falling. There? Yeah. That's a person getting sucked into a black hole.
he looks kind of relaxed, I suppose, for that sort of situation. But like coincidentally, these colors are also pretty similar to some of the paint scheme that I've got on my Infinity, my O12. So I'd throw this on when I'm playing with my O12 just to like color match a little
bit. Get in the headspace.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to get some sick graphic tees like this one, you can go to intotheam.com/ghostfiregaming. Get 10% off through that link. I'll throw it into the Twitch chat, or use Ghostfire Gaming one word at checkout to get that 10% discount. Let me throw the link in there. I mean, hilariously, I don't know if you remember the one I was wearing last time, the kind of like Japanese style staircase going up through the mountains with the tree on it. I was eating fish and chips over the weekend because of Good Friday, and I spilled some tartar sauce on the shirt by accident, and I rubbed it off and it still looked like it was part of the design. I was like, am I pulling this off? Nah, I better change my shirt. And I got a fresh Into the AM shirt instead. So that's my story. And I'm sticking to it.
Ben Byrne, he's just like you.
Only covered in tartar sauce.
Speaking of being covered in tartar sauce, a report was done, jumping back into the tabletop RPG news, a report was done by a website called ICV2, which I'd never heard of before, but they are a digital trade magazine that covers geek culture, specifically around retailers, focusing on products for comics, anime, show business, and gaming. I found out about this because EN World have done a report on it, report on the report that was reported upon. And I don't have 100% of the information here because the really detailed report ICV2 did was behind a paywall, that I chose not to get behind. But if you want to go read the detailed thing there, you can. But we're going to go through the broad strokes. They are pulling data about, retail sales for, tabletop RPGs, sort of tabletop gaming in general. The important ground rules to note is that this report includes sales from specialist game stores only, not Amazon, which I think is important, and not Wizards of the Coast direct sales, which I also think is important because it very likely, in fact, almost certainly does not cover D&D Beyond sales. It does include, now, EN World said it included Kickstarter, but then if you go to the ICV2 website, the article that is public that you can see used the word crowdfunding, because my question was, does it just include Kickstarter data, or are they including BackerKit and GameFound as well and other crowdfunding sources? So I'm going to assume that they are including all of them based on the ICV2 website. And in the hobby games categories that they drew upon, this includes board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures, and collectibles. Collectibles, okay. I'm assuming, possibly trading cards, but it might also mean like toys, I assume.
Maybe like pop vinyls and stuff as well.
Mm. Possibly, yeah. Yeah. I was thinking like those really detailed, like Iron Man with the comes in 70 bits and you got to put him together and the head swaps.
Where did you already say where it lands on like Target and stuff?
It doesn't say. I'm going to assume it doesn't include big box stores, as I learned the term last year, because the quote that I have here is just specialist game and card stores.
Cool. Okay.
Yes. So this information, a lot of people are going to look at this information and they're going to try and convince you of something because the heading on the EN World article, which is kind of the most interesting heading to get people to click on the article, is D&D sales down 30% in 2023. That's kind of the big takeaway, is that there was a drop in D&D sales, 30%. The little brackets there should be in specialist game stores. Because that doesn't necessarily, to my mind at least, mean that D&D is selling 30% less. It could mean that some of those sales are going to D&D Beyond directly now. People are migrating from purchasing physical books in game stores to purchasing books just on D&D Beyond. That's a possibility. I don't know that. And so, yeah, there's a lot of conclusions that can be drawn from this data. So I would just be careful in kind of... you know, making definitive statements about this information. All of that out of the way, what was the information?
I'm really grateful for the nuance with which you've approached this data, because just like you said, it's very easy to want to say something that is, you know, untrue or otherwise myopic when looking at data like this. So you know, this is the kind of hard-hitting journalism people come to the Lorecast for.
I appreciate that. That being said, the thumbnail is probably going to be the Stonks meme with the arrow pointing down and Dale's shocked face.
Ben, you're
and
terrible.
The title will say, "Is Dungeons & Dragons Dying?" Something like that. And if you came here, you fell for it again. I got you again.
Wait, I'm going to try an angry one for it.
All right, great. Okay, perfect.
Wonderful.
Every time we do this face bit, it's just great radio for our podcast listeners, you know?
That is true. That is fair.
Although, so sorry.
Depending on your app, because we just upload the video everywhere. So I think in Spotify, you can actually watch the video version. I don't know.
Yeah, but it doesn't help if you're listening while driving.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's true for people on YouTube as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Having said that, I feel like they could picture the YouTube face.
Yeah.
I feel like they know.
They know in their heart.
Face here, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So the information being that hobby games, as mentioned, including board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures, and collectibles, grew by 1%. There was a 1% market increase in 2023, which is incredibly small compared to the previous years. Tiny compared to 2022, which saw 7% growth. The hobby games market eked out a 7% growth in 2022, and it was even higher during the COVID years, growths between kind of 10% to I think even 20%. I think it was at like a 30% increase in total from 2020 to 2022. But within that 1% increase, a lot of the big growth areas, difficult to replicate events like the Magic the Gathering, Lord of the Rings set, selling extremely well, kind of contributing to that growth, whilst certain areas saw a decline, including D&D hobby store sales were down 30%. The report citing their impression of the reason why, the coming new edition possibly slowing down people purchasing those core books for the time being, the movie performing kind of a bit lackluster and not what was hoped for, and as we continue to come out of the pandemic-fueled high of retail sales. They say that while the OGL fiasco, crisis, whatever word you want to use from last year, did have some effect on what they're terming as lifestyle gamers. If you're listening to this podcast, you're likely a lifestyle gamer, being that playing games is part of your lifestyle. It did not really have any effect on like newer customers coming in or more casual players entering the hobby who didn't really know what was going on in the first place. So they're not saying that the OGL had a huge impact on that 30% decrease. And that potentially also older D&D players are migrating to other systems, apparently Pathfinder being one that's benefiting from that, but it was used as an example, not the example.
Here is a not shocking statistic. After a game has been out for a long time, fewer people play it. Usually we would be reporting this news 4 years or 5 years after an edition comes out. We are hearing this news 10 years after a new edition came out with all the other PR fiascos that happened with Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro over that time. Unfathomable that an edition would go that long with an increase in sales. So this is not surprising. Is it 30%? Maybe not. You know, maybe overall it's 20% or 15%. I would not be surprised if it was 30% everywhere. Because when you say to your fan base, oh, by the way, this edition that you're playing, we're going to replace it, you are going to see a decrease in sales. You can say it's going to be compatible. You can say you can still use your old books. You can say all of those things. The message is what you're doing now will not be what you will be doing next year. And that will automatically lead to a decrease in sales interest. People will look for other ways to fulfill that lifestyle choice that they've made by playing other games. The real question for me is, when these books come out mid-2024 and into 2025, what will the sales look like? Will it be an increase back up 30%? Will it be an increase back up 10%? What would be the percentage that you would need to increase then in order to say, people are back on board, people are back playing this game? That's the question that interests me the most. So right now, you out there who want to say Wizards is doing great or Wizards is doing terrible, ask yourself, what number do you need to see to make it a success or a failure? And then see what the reports are, so then you can gauge what is a success or failure.
And then we can speculate on what is causing 5.5 to behave the way it is. Is it MCDM and Daggerheart and Valiant eating into their domain? Is it those games being roundly thrashed? Is it 5e fatigue? Is it ambivalence towards the rules refresh? Or will it be a runaway hit in the way that 2014's 5e release was? It's an exciting time.
I am not entirely convinced of what I'm about to say, but it is the ponderance I am pondering at this moment. When we're dealing with such a narrow sort of demographic for this statistics base, right? And I do think it's valuable to look at this stuff to sort of cut out all of the non-lifestyle gamers. I don't know why I find that phrase so hurtful. But I kind of do.
Okay, fair enough. Game. It's not like they just said the nerds. Nerds
noticed, there's nothing actually wrong with it, but I would prefer to just be called the nerds.
Right, okay, fair enough.
I cannot say why, but it is how I feel. I think there is value in looking at this narrower slice of the community and the consumer base. But it is sort of pinging a similar thing in my head to when you are a content creator. If you create for a niche, you will see a lot more growth, like very quickly. But you plateau, right? Like you hit a point where everyone who's looking for that niche thing can find you because not everyone's doing that, right? It's like, so D&D content is already a niche, but then within that, I am a DM creator and I create homebrew, right? So it's niche. And so people who are looking for that content can find it easily, and they find it and they enjoy it and they eat it all up and it's great. But you do hit a point where everyone who is looking for that has found it. And that kind of rings a similar bell in terms of, if we're looking at people who go to hobby stores, they've had so much time that everyone who is that kind of person who wants to buy these books has done that. And you can, you know, release a new book every year, but those books are catering to a different thing. So you're sort of naturally going to see this kind of plateau. So, I mean, I'm basically just sort of reframing all the same things that Sean and James said, but it's, you know, I don't know. It's just, and what you said, Ben, it's the same thing again. It's just, you have to kind of keep a whole different set of expectations in mind when you're looking at this data compared to broader data. And things like the difference, this is a tiny little difference, but like someone might be at a big box store and they go, oh, my nephew likes that dragon game. I'll buy this thing. I don't know why they have that voice, but they do. And so, you know, it's a thing where you're passing by and you see it versus, my kid has developed this special interest and I am going to go and seek it out. And often those parents will find themselves at something like a hobby store. So there's a bit of a difference there. I don't know. I'm very interested in the kind of ramifications of the choice of data collection.
And how they collected this data sounds very interesting as well, because they were like drawing sales figures from publicly available information from publicly trading companies, but also talking with, I believe, like store owners or possibly franchise owners. But it's not like they were drawing this information from lots of different places, it sounded like, on the ICV2 website, as opposed to like having one place where they were able to get like definitive sounding data.
Roman just said the same thing I was thinking in chat. Do we know the geographics of it? Is it just American data?
But probably. And the other thing we don't know
specifically
is when they're talking about D&D, do they also just mean Wizards of the Coast, right? Because, you know, Ghostfire is now on retail stores as of last year.
If they're just talking about Wizards of the Coast.
Oh, good point.
Because there's the tabletop category, but then they pull out D&D hobby store sales are down 30%. Yeah. Because also what counts is like D&D, right? Because there's obviously 5e games that go to Kickstarter, but I believe there are others that also draw on earlier SRDs, right? From earlier editions.
Mm-hmm. So it's a question of how it gets categorized in the little,
As Mark Twain said, there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's statistics.
You know, all this talk about new editions being more accessible, comics liking to start from issue number one because they're more accessible to new readers. What do you think would happen if we just started with episode one all over again, right? If the next episode was episode one of the Eldritch Lorecast.
So people aren't overwhelmed by the numbers.
Exactly.
To be completely honest with you, I think a lot of people would tune out because while comics do well with the first issue, the first start of the story, podcasts, and no disrespect to ourselves or any other podcast out there, episode one is usually pretty
swifty.
You're right.
You gotta find your stride, you know. Yeah.
In episode one, they just talk about jazz the whole time.
No, but the second episode one, that's a different story.
But that's what's interesting about that though, Ben, is that like, yes, episode one usually is pretty swifty. But what if you're 300th episode was labeled episode one. And so people came to it and they were like, oh, well, this must be the first one. I guess I should start here. But because it's actually your 300th episode that's just called episode one, it looks like you have a really great first episode.
Okay, that's true.
We could do it like the new God of War games, right? God of War 2018. Eldritch Lorecast episode one, 2024.
Are we doing a new edition of the Eldritch Lorecast? Yeah. Sure. Is it backwards compatible?
Much more streamlined.
Yeah. New player friendly.
Advanced Eldritch Lorecast.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if we're going to go back to episode one, just looking at the stills from that, we'd have particularly James and Dale sitting like up, like they want to go out to playtime first. Which was entirely our fault. We were like very like, you've got to sit up and you've got to like, you know, we've relaxed a lot since those early episodes. Speaking of relaxing, a listener question from Spotify. That's right. If you didn't know, you can leave comments and questions on Spotify. And this one came from Nick, who asked, how do you run dreams / visions, such as something that is prophetic or otherwise? My mind thinks of augury, as in Ben's mind, not Nick's mind. How do you run dreams / visions mechanically and also not make them feel repetitive while trying to convey the same ideas?
I would run it like a solo adventure, with the caveat that it's probably happening at a larger table. So keep it short, stupid. Just remember KISS. Keep it short, stupid.
Keep it short? We always said keep it simple.
No, you're right. Keep it simple is the acronym, but I'm I'm adjusting it for me.
I like it.
Yeah. You want to do something that's punchy and dramatic, because dreams in fantasy must be dramatic. But you don't want to bore everyone else sitting around the table, nor do you want, honestly, to bore the person whose dream you're narrating, right? Because if your dream is just a cutscene, then, you know, this could have been a text RP, or this could have been an email. This dream sequence could have been an email, is not what you want your players to be thinking when you're running it.
It depends on what you're trying to do with the dream, right? Are you trying to provide information that is going to be useful down the line, rather than having a big lore dump? You are going to say, and you dream this. Then absolutely, as James said, keep it short. Is the dream an adventure that everyone in the party is sharing? Well, then you can do different things with that. Are you trying to establish a theme or a mood or a tone or an atmosphere? Then there are different ways to do that. Is this the result of a curse from a hag? Right. There have been monsters where the hag causes you to dream, and it's a curse. If that's the case, then there are different ways to work that. It depends on, have a reason to do the dream. And the reason that you choose to do the dream will dictate the way that you handle it at the table, in the game, using certain rules or not other rules, etc.
I took a class that I really loved at uni that was specifically, it was about dreams and visions throughout the history of literature, right? So we talked about from the ancient Greeks, we looked at the Aeneid, we looked at Dante's Inferno, Roman. Actually, technically, Virgil wrote the Aeneid, so that's also Roman. But anyway, but, you know, we worked our way up. We worked through the Victorians. We worked into, you know, modern plays, you know, just going through this whole kind of thing. We looked at Freud, even though I hate Freud. But it's really fascinating kind of looking at the history of human culture in relation to dreams, and how dreams and visions are kind of interconnected with one another in the way that we tell stories. There's such fascinating stuff in there, right? Like the idea that dreams are connected with the idea of prophecy because of things like we can see in dreams people who have died. And that is the only time that happens, or it was. And actually, when the gramophone was invented and you could hear the voice of someone who had died, they were like, well, this is how we're going to be able to speak to the dead, because that was the first time outside of dreams that you could do that. But, you know, it's this idea of, oh, well, we can connect to something beyond through our dreams. And so I really love kind of digging into that stuff. I have previously, when I run dreams, and particularly kind of vision-esque dreams in my games, I don't like it to be too direct. I don't like it to be, oh, you are being visited by your warlock patron who is giving you a message. I really love for it to be in that dream space, that nebulous, weird space. I love to dig into the character background, or the ideals and bonds and flaws and those things, and kind of figure out what a core message is, put it through like three layers of filter so it becomes very metaphorical. Every time I say metaphorical now, I just think of Parasite. It's very metaphorical. But, you know, you end up with this core metaphor, and then dress it in the trappings of a dream, because dreams are freaking weird, right? Like, have those little things that are common across dreams that you maybe don't think about all the time, but they really make something pop as feeling like a dream. Things like, you know, oh, well, you looked like a tiefling in the dream, but I knew it was you. You know what I mean? That right. sort of a thing where it's like, sometimes you're just hanging out with like George Clooney, but you're like, no, but I knew it was my brother, but he looks like George Clooney's Batman.
Batman specifically?
These things happen. Sure. I wouldn't say, you know, use George Clooney's Batman in your D&D dream, but, you know, there are weird things like that. There are things like the space between getting places maybe doesn't exist. You know, you walk through a door and suddenly you're at your high school. There are weird little things that break the rules of reality in dreams. And frankly, look, I know it's old hat, but Inception got a lot of them right. It was like, you don't think about it in the dream. And the minute you start thinking about it, things start to collapse. But I don't know. I think really sort of my advice would be the practical advice is look at their bonds, ideals, and flaws. I think you can find a lot of juice in that stuff that doesn't get used ever. And you can get so much out of it for your games. But, you know, dig into their background, dig into their bonds, ideals, and flaws. But also, frankly, if you have the time, look into, you know, famous stories about dreams. One of my favorites, very weird, Chaucer's House of Fame. Really fun. Very, very dreamlike. I don't know. Just go digging. Go looking for great depictions of dreams in literature and media. Oh, if you want a modern one, Buffy regularly does really great prophetic dreams. There's a whole episode of them. It's called Restless. It's the final episode of season 4. I don't know. Go looking. Go find stuff. Think about the weird dreams you've had and write stuff down.
Well, you made me think of a really interesting idea, and I hesitate to say a good idea, but a really interesting idea, where you, the DM, tell a player, you had a really bizarre and meaningful feeling dream, so you scrambled to write down as much of it as you could remember before you forgot it, and you hand them a slip of paper.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah. I love that.
Your player's got to trust you to be able to say your character did something, but I feel like that's a low enough level of trust required to say you wrote down a dream that you half remember, right?
Yeah. I think that's really cool. One of the things that I really struggle with seeing dreams depicted in the real world is that, to me, even when I'm really bought into a dream, even when I like don't know that I'm dreaming and I'm very active in the dream and I'm like, this is real life, there's something ethereal about dreams that just the very nature of depicting them in the real world cannot capture. Like, Inception to me looks too sci-fi for it to necessarily accurately represent dreams because of that thing that you said exactly, which is, you know, it's George Clooney, but I knew it was my brother. Or, you know, I had a dream just the other night where I was living in my house that I used to live in, you know, two houses ago, where we had a park across the road from us, but the inside of the house was a different house entirely that physically would not have fit within that space, but I don't question it within the dream because I'm just within, you know, the dream space. So making that point leading to, I tried something that I don't think was 100% successful, but it was a magic item that was an orb. And the idea was that it allowed the wizard to kind of like use it as a brain external to their own brain. So it allowed a spellcaster to like concentrate on multiple spells and cast spells at higher level. And that was kind of the good thing it did. But it was also a cursed magic item that would trap them within their own dreamscape. Because they get trapped, their kind of consciousness gets trapped within the orb. And the party had to go in and rescue them. So they all have to go to sleep next to the orb to go into the mind of the person attuned to the magic item. So it was an Inception-like idea. And what I wanted to do, which I don't think I pulled off particularly well, but basically improvise an entire dungeon where the player who's having the dream tells me what's in the next room. And then I just decide whether it's a fight, a puzzle, or a role-playing encounter. And we kind of explore their backstory as a party that way. And it didn't go for very long. We kind of aborted the idea a little bit earlier. I also didn't really have an end game in mind to it, but it was kind of one of those things where I didn't want to plan it out too much, but I felt like I hadn't done enough planning to be able to pull it off properly. The one thing that I would have changed, though, was any combat encounter. If you use the battle grid and miniatures, if you do a combat encounter in a dream, do it entirely theater of the mind instead, just so it doesn't feel like it has any physicality
concrete,
to it.
Yeah, mm-hmm,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of, you know, if you use 5, 10, 15 feet in your game, 30 feet range, 40 foot, just change for that session, even if you're using 5e, to near, far, and distant, you know, so that it doesn't feel you're kind of almost like floating around a little bit within the dream and the dream space that you're in. Because dream, like the scene in a dream can change entirely and seem completely normal to you. You know, you walk into a chapel and it's a wedding and you go up to the bride because they're your sister or something, and then you're having coffee with her in a coffee shop and it's all the same scene and nothing's changed and, you know, it's completely congruous to you in your mind, and finding ways to do things like that might be harder with physical miniatures on a board. Mm. Anyway.
Yeah. I would just like to take this moment to tell you all, I had a dream last night with so many spiders in it. There were so many spiders.
There were
Aussie
spiders too. That's
it was really, it was a lot.
I had a dream with cane toads, which are a Queensland thing.
Yeah, it's a Queensland thing. That's interesting.
We don't get as many cane toads down here in Victoria. So Queensland have them all the time though. And my wife, she wanted to walk the dog, but cane toads, I think this is true. It was true in the dream. I don't know if it's true in real life. But cane toads are poisonous if a dog like eats them or plays with them or whatever. So Tori went out into the park that I lived across the road from, which had like 7 cane toads in it, and she just had to kick them all. And she was out there just kicking the cane toads. And that was my dream, to make it safe to walk the dog.
Man, she was really kicking the cane toads in that dream. Huh?
She was like kicking them, you know, like 30 feet. She was like, you know, virtually drop kicking them without picking them up, you know.
I know that tonight I am going to dream about squirrels, thanks to y'all.
Well, let me say, if we spirits have offended, think but this and all is mended, that thou have but slumbered here whilst these visions did appear. And that is as much of that monologue as I remember. But that is the end of this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. If you enjoyed it, feel free to follow us on Twitch. We're almost at 1,000 followers. Yay! Thank you for following us if you are already. You can subscribe on the platform if you're on YouTube or Spotify or Podcatcher or CastPod or the podcast network. Whatever you're listening to this, you can stars, likes, whatever your app craves, we crave it too. It feeds our psychic dream energy. So do that. I've been Ben Byrne here with Sean Merwin, Dale Kingsmill, James Hake, and we will be back next week. Next week, 9 a.m. for Australians. Sorry, I know I said that last week. I messed up the times. So the streaming time, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Monday, 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time Monday, Tuesday Australia time, 9 a.m. Dale and I look forward to seeing you then. And Dante.
So sad.
Bapada 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 bapada. Oh, no, swing version.
I don't know if we went swing, but it was something.
I don't know what swing is, honestly. I just think of it like kind of like jazz, but without brass.
Ben, that's what? No. Swing has nothing to do with whether or not there's brass. There's of swing with brass. All it means is that you syncopate your eighth notes. It's da 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 rather than da 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 da.